In the Me Too era, I've been struggling with an inescapable awareness that compassion has its limits. I was visiting with a congregant's daughter who was moving to an area near where I had once lived, and describing the neighborhood she was moving to. And since I had lived there, I know that the neighborhood had gone through a bit of gentrification. And my comment to her was, oh, that's a great neighborhood. You're going to have so much fun. It's, you know, wealthier now. She wasn't talking about housing stock. She was talking about her fear of violence between the subway and her home. And no matter how many African American friends I have, no matter how many transgender persons I work with, no matter living in a gay neighborhood, there's a limit to what I understand. Simple truth is, I had a lot of bad dates when I was younger, and I was never anxious about any of them ending in violence. And that's probably the experience of almost every woman and others in this room. And I bring this to you because we are not exonerated. We have been complicit. Our faith, our Torah, our religion, just like many religious systems, has been a perpetrator. And I want to come clean about that, be honest and accountable for our transgressions, and strive for a narrow pathway forward. Let me start with what doesn't work. I would call it tentatively the fallacy of Eshet Chayil, or the fallacy of the divine feminine. So I was working with a young woman about a month ago, and she asked me my sensibility about the divine feminine. And I said, isn't that just another form of gendering God? And she said, no, what about the divine parts that are soft and gentle? And I said, well, that's already a kind of sexism to assume that genders need to be exclusively differentiated that way. The other fallacy that fails us, I think, I would call it, no offense to the book of Proverbs, and no offense to persons even like myself who've read this passage to their spouses and loved ones on Shabbat, a bit of the Eshet Chayil fallacy. That it's enough for a woman to be a loving homemaker, that it's enough for a woman to be industrious in certain spheres, but not in the Senate. This is expounded, I think, accidentally, but very clearly to me in a passage by the beloved Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, probably writing now, 75 years ago. He writes this in the tribute to the Rebbetzin of Talne, whom I don't know. I think it's his mother or someone related to him. She taught me that there is a flavor, a warmth to mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of his hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which were often transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. It's a beautiful tribute to a Yiddish mama. But still, I think, we can discuss this at another point, lacking. I was at a very traditional wedding in the past year, and I was very discomforted by one piece, which was that a very traditional ketubah was read, which, let's put no bones about it, let's not whitewash our tradition. A ketubah is traditionally a bill of sale for chattels, that a woman becomes the property of her husband's household, and he has to indemnify her against damages. And A literal translation was not conveniently read. It was described as, this is the document that illustrates how the man will love the woman, and the woman's spiritual nature is elevated to his. And that's why women don't get to sign the document. They're too elevated. And in line with, I think, what I would describe as that fallacy, and this might, I just realized Max and Elkanon are in here, but I'll try to be careful with my words. Although I think I've had this conversation with my son already. Is the sensibility that there are exceptions, so that's enough. There's Miriam and her well and the way that the people, she was beloved of the people. There's, in Midrash, On, the son of Pelet, who rescued his wife from the Korach's rebellion, whose wife rescued him from the Korach's rebellion. There's Deborah, the valorous judge who ruled the disgruntled and disparate tribes in the period prior to the kingdom. There's Rabbi Meir's wife, Bruria, who prays for the wicked and convinces him, Rabbi Bruria, to change his opinion. These seem in some ways exceptions to prove my point. They're narrow, and they are not given the space of ink and recitation and richness of character. In most cases, I can see you're already planning to tell me something different after, that their male counterparts of are, which may be the exception of Rebecca and Isaac. I think nowhere is this stronger than in the daughters of Tzlofechad, who in the book of Numbers come before Moses and note that their father died in the wilderness, and they will lose their inheritance because inheritance patterns have not yet been arranged to cover women who have no father or brothers. So Moses prays before God and made to understand that the inheritance patterns will, in some cases, include women. And in Midrash, in rabbinic imagination, perhaps almost a century later, they put in the mouths of the daughters of Tzlofechad the phrase that God's mercy and compassion is not like the compassion of humankind. Mankind favors men over women. God isn't like that. God's compassion extends to men and women alike. Which is quite a beautiful statement of proto-egalitarianism. Here's the problem. What have I called them the entire time? The daughters of Tzlofechad. They have names. Their names are Mochla, Noah, Hogla, Milka, and Tirza, and we never call them by their names. Now, that's a mouthful. Maybe we could make the defense, oh, that's a mouthful. It's easier just to refer them as the family of Tzlofechad. But it's just another way of neutering and taking away the voice and names of women, which happens far too often in the world, and certainly in our tradition. And we are accountable for it. Considering that idea of the exception proving the rule that these female characters are writ small and not given the fleshed out nature, Eric Auerbach would say that most of our Bible is not giving the fleshed out nature, that a lot rests in the background and little is in the foreground. But I think all the more so in a story like Miriam, where her song at the sea is two or three verses and Moses' song at the sea is over a dozen. So Janet Malcolm, an author from Prague, but who resided in America, wrote in The New Yorker, this is, I find, quite beautiful, that minor characters in biography, like counterparts in fiction, are less tenderly treated than major characters. So I think the comparison I think of is a coal miner's daughter relative to Harlan County, USA, fiction versus nonfiction. The writer uses them to advance his narrative and carelessly drops them when they have performed their function. But unlike in Madame Bovary, for example, unlike the flat characters of fiction who have no existence outside the novel, that they were just invented to ornament, unlike a minor character in Dickens or Flaubert or Graham Greene, the flat characters of biography are actual, real, three-dimensional people. And the author can't worry about those people who never got asked to be dragged into that shaky enterprise anyway. I feel like that's the psychological underpinning of the lack of egalitarianism that has pervaded our tradition and history. It's too hard, as we talked about yesterday, to think of every human being as a full three-dimensional person. It's much easier to exclude, to flatten, to narrow, to stereotype. But here's the rub with feminist issues as well as LGBT issues, as well as race issues, as well as issues of poverty. If we were to hold ourselves accountable for these acts, we also have to recognize that it has perpetrated violence throughout generations. This is a violence that's called technically religious or sometimes spiritual abuse. The ways in which religion can be used, is used, unfortunately, to harm others. We know this in every sphere. This is not just about women. This is about race and poverty and Christian versus Jew, Jew versus Muslim, Palestinian versus Israeli. It's a way in which we use religion rather than a bridge as a cudgel to harm others. It's part and parcel of Scripture. It really, in some places, comes down to what parts are you going to read and focus on. But the problem of our complicity in religious abuse, at least against women, is put pithily by Margaret Atwood. Some of you may know where I'm about to quote. Men are afraid women will laugh at them. Women are afraid men will kill them. Or as Amy Schumer paraphrases in her recent stand-up, "Oh, are you carrying your keys between your knuckles because you're worried someone's going to make a joke about you?" I don't know what finally prompted me to say all this, except that it's become in the past years an awareness that I can't escape. And I look around the room at the faces of the women in the room and men. And I apologize for this difficult conversation, but I can't seem to breathe without it. And that Margaret Atwood quote, the sensibility that men's positions of priority and power within a religious system can do harm and damage to others, is illustrated in one of my all-time favorite Midrashim. So when Abram and Sarai, then, are trying to conceive, and shortly thereafter they'll conceive Ishmael through Hagar, Sarai says to Abraham, "My wrong, chamasi alecha, my wrong is against you, my wrong is opposed to you," which is to say, "I have a grievance for you." And here's the parable our sages offer. Imagine there were two men incarcerated in prison, and the king is making his rounds of the prison. I don't know why kings go down to the dungeons. I don't know if this actually happened in any society. And one of the prisoners cries out, "Execute justice for me." So the king orders that prisoner released. But the guy next to him says, you could have said, "Execute justice for us." If the king was in a pardoning mood, he would have listened to what you said and pardoned us. Since you said just for yourself, just for the first person singular, he released you, but not me. So too the parable returns to Abram and Sarai and notes that Abram prayed for his own fertility, his own capacity to bear children, but not for Sarai's. And so through Ishmael, he was granted a child, but she was not. So we are, I think, implicit in that story and in all of Jewish tradition, again and again repeating about the widow, the stranger, and the orphan, required to look after those and to assert ourselves on behalf of those whose voices are diminished or missing, those whose names are eluded and elided under the names of their fathers, those whose stories are shorter than their counterpart that is a man, those whose professional aspirations are blocked in a way that their male counterparts are not, those who are at risk for violence and endangerment, whereas those who outweigh them by 60 pounds of muscle feel safer walking the street at night. But there is, as I suggested, a thin canyon, a slot canyon, to navigate through our tradition and to find new voices and spaces for women and, frankly, for our LGBT brothers and sisters, for non-Jews, for the poor, for those who are vulnerable, generally and period. So I did some research on what's now being called the four waves of feminism. Without giving you an historic lecture, this sort of fits in the background of what I'm speaking of. So there are at least two places I found in our tradition that might point us forward to a rereading of the tradition through an egalitarian lens. The first is the creation story, that God created them male and female, Genesis 1:27. So there's a midrash, and I think it comes from Aristotelian creation ideas, that originally there was an androgyn, a creature born of male and female that was equal in parts. I never understood if it's like a circle and split in half, but that's the image, that there was one two-sided creature, and in the creation the sides were hewed and split in half, implying perhaps a rare and narrow and unusual understanding of the ultimate equality and equity between sexes and genders. And then, of course, there's the apocryphal story about Rashi's daughters wearing tefillin, which I've never seen in a reputable source, but some of you have heard it, that Rashi, the great 11th century sage, only had daughters, and he allowed them to wear tefillin, the typically male instrument. I've never seen that written, but there is a much earlier source that suggests that it was possible. So under the rubric of male and female clothing, there's a quote in the Talmud that Michal, the daughter of the Cushite, wore tefillin, and the rabbis did not attempt to prohibit her. And the wife of Jonah, not, I don't believe, the prophet, attended festival pilgrimages, which is to say acted the man's role in the festival pilgrimages, and the sages did not prevent her. There is precedent, is what I'm saying. And since our entire system of halakha is a precedential system, much like the American legal system operates on precedent, unlike the continental legal system, there's a wedge. There's a thin sliver, a shim, that we can use to drive this issue in our tradition and to ensure that my sons, future generations, will live in a world that approaches true parity, at least parity of opportunity. So now I'm going to quote a local sage. Aleha HaShalom, may her memory be blessed. At her home Seder, pouring Miriam's cup, which is a relatively new innovation to have a cup both for Elijah and for Miriam, a child asked her, "What's feminism?" To which Ethel Wittenberg replies, "A feminist is someone who knows that anything a boy can do, a girl can do just as well or better." Amen ve amen. It's a long road, and we're in so many ways still at the base of the mountain. In so many ways, just at the fork in the road, the opening of the path, the beginning of a long journey. It's my prayer for you, I've mentioned it jokingly, that if, God forbid, I should ever leave, your next rabbi could be a woman. Before I conclude with a poem, I want to tell you one final story from the Talmud. which I forget who's telling the story, unfortunately. I was on a journey and I saw a little boy sitting at a crossroad. And I said to him, by what road do we go to town? And he says, this one is short but long. And that one is long but short. So I went on the short but long road. And when I approached town, I discovered that the road got hedged in by gardens and orchards. So I turned back and I said to him, didn't you tell me that that road was short? And the boy replied, didn't I also tell you, but long? It's a long journey. We have just started in so many ways in the scheme of human history to reach a place where all can aspire to equality. Not necessarily equality of choice. We can make our own choices. It's no less legitimate to be a rabbi than it is to take care of four boys. I wouldn't trade my job for my wife's any day. But we can ensure that everyone gets to make the choice. And everyone gets to live without fear. And no one has to decide between career and family. A question that never in my life have I had to consider. I'm going to leave you with a poem. And this poem is prima facie, on its surface, about the African-American experience in America. And with the exception of one or two lines, it's also about the experience of women in America. It's by Maya Angelou. Still I Rise, from 1978. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Because I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns with the certainty of tides, just like hopes springing high, still, I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't take it awful hard, because I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that's wondrously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of a slave. I rise. You can join me if you'd like. I rise. I rise.